gets the urge for going when the meadow grass is turning brown and all her empires falling down and winter's closing in. And I get the urge for going when the meadow grass is turning brown and summertime is falling.
This program is presented by the KGNU Listener Members and by Bars Listening Lounge, presenting songwriter and performer Danny O'Keefe, composer of classic songs Uncle Charlie Sings the Blues and Angel Spread Your Wings, on Thursday, October 29th, 8 p.m. Bars is located at 1512 Curtis Street in Denver. Tickets and more information on this and other concerts at barsmagic.com, B-A-U-R-S, magic.com.
Welcome to Ragtime America. I'm Jack Rummel. I'll be with you for an hour of recorded ragtime and related music this evening. And you may have noticed that our theme song is a little different tonight. We're hearing the magnetic rag as played by Scott Joplin on a piano roll. And that's because our topic tonight will be part one of a two-part series on the evolution of the piano roll over the years and its importance in the field of ragtime and related music. Our interview tonight will be with Paul Johnson. Paul and I became friends many years ago, having attended a lot of ragtime festivals together, and I knew Paul was a collector of piano rolls. But our ways sort of parted and we lost touch with each other, but we reunited this past year at the West Coast Ragtime Festival. And in a lengthy conversation, the topic came up that maybe Paul would be interested in doing an interview and a subsequent program on piano rolls. Well, he jumped at the chance and I was excited. So we will be talking with Paul this evening, and we will be interspersing his conversation with specific selections that he has chosen to emphasize the topics that he will be discussing. So, having said all of that, let's just fade out Mr. Joplin here, and we'll bring up our interview with Paul Johnson. Well, we're speaking tonight with Paul Johnson. Welcome to our microphone, Paul.
Thank you, Jack. I appreciate the opportunity.
You know, I have known you for a long time. I was trying to figure it out. I bet it's over 25 years. And
yeah.
I have always associated you as a collector of music, and I guess especially piano rolls. Would that be a fair definition?
Well, that's one of the collections, probably the major one. As you know, both you and I enjoy ragtime LPs too, but rolls are certainly a big part.
How did you get started collecting rolls?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, like a lot of us in the 70s, we were reading Rags and Ragtime, and I noticed that they talked about how the sheet music Once you got out of the Joplin and the Stark published pieces, that things were watered down. And, you know, I thought about player pianos. I had an aunt who had one growing up, and we would play that. And I thought, well, if you had piano rolls, you wouldn't have that limitation of having to have the piece easily available or playable by, you know, a small group of people or by a group of people. And so I thought, well, that would be a good way to kind of learn things and learn how people played things.
Okay. Well, that's as good an explanation as I could have come up with. Is there a definition for mechanical music?
Well, there's probably a lot of them. You know, basically, they're machines that were designed to play music. And most of them are what they call self-playing instruments, in that there's no, you know, real human interaction intended for it. And, you know, things like music boxes or, you know, we're probably familiar with band organs, which would be playing with a carousel. And then there's things like Nickelodeons. But, of course, player pianos are also mechanical music. Phonographs don't really get counted into that category, as I understand it or define it. One thing about player pianos, though, is that they're not really self-playing. They really require someone to play it, and they were intended to have someone give a performance on it.
I see. Was a tune from the 20s, a pop tune called Floating Down the Old Green River, played by Pete Wendling. And Paul says that Wendling is renowned by roll collectors for his ragged playing style. And apparently in his day, he won some ragtime piano playing contests as well. Paul mentioned that he was reading in the book Rags and Ragtime. Actually, later when we were reviewing his interview, he said, well, I misspoke there. I had a slight brain lapse, and he meant to refer to the seminal book that came out in the 1950s by Rudy Blesch and Harriet Janis called They All Played Ragtime. All right, well, let's get on with more of our interview from Paul Johnson. Now, why, with the availability that we have today of sheet music collections and cylinder recordings, LP records, digital recordings, and so on, why does mechanical music continue to be important as far as ragtime is concerned?
Oh, sure. Well, a number of reasons. I think certainly sheet music is very important, but if you want to really understand how people played it during its time period, during its heyday, you really have to go to the recordings. And because the piano didn't record very well on phonograph, you don't find a whole lot of piano recordings during the time, but you do find piano rolls. And so you will find pieces that were never even published in sheet music. It doesn't happen a lot, but it happens enough. And, you know, things like Silver Swan, and there's a lot of other pieces that were only recorded on piano roll. And then you have, like I said, these professional artists at the time who would record rolls during the hand played era, and you can hear how the kind of tricks they used. In fact, you know, we're familiar with something with the book Rags and Ragtime, and that covers a lot of the ragtime pieces that were recorded. But there's a great library of popular songs, and they're interpreted in a ragtime style during the period. So that's very important. And also, I would say there's just some great kind of ragtime arrangers. The one that the piano roll folks like a lot is a lady named May Brown, or Mary Brown. She worked for the U.S. Music Roll Company, and she would infuse a lot of her arrangements with ragtime or syncopation just to liven them up. And there was another guy who worked for the Link Company, and his name was Ray Deo, and he did kind of the same type of thing.
Now, I've got some CDs that are beginning to show their age, and a few of them I can't even play anymore. And phonograph records get scratched over time. How reliable are piano rolls?
Well, you know, they're amazingly reliable. I mean, they're in some ways they're as reliable, if not more reliable, than sheet music in the sense of holding up. Now, of course, you know, we'll still have to see how things do with age, but I have piano rolls that were made in the 1890s, and they are, you know, still very hardy today. In fact, sometimes the ones that are most in danger of just self-destructing are ones that were made later during the 30s because they used a very cheap, high acidity paper because they weren't expected to last a long time and they had to really cut costs. And so those rolls are actually more in danger. But things that were produced, say, from the 1890s up into, you know, up to the Depression, the paper is very good. And even some of the stuff in the Depression is pretty decent as well. So, you know, it's reliable, or it's a media that's kind of hung around for quite some time.
If you take good care of them, they're going to last quite a while.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that applies to just about anything we collect over the years.
Well, you know, it does, although it was interesting. I was at Stanford recently. They had a thing called Reaction to the Record. They had just bought a big collection of piano rolls and were kind of putting those on display. But in part of that, they talked about, you know, they have a huge library of all different types of music. And I guess they store some of their tape recordings out in a special place out in Livermore, California. And I imagine that magnetic tape is actually something that you really have to be careful with over time because, again, it wasn't really, you know, they were putting it together as best they could, but it doesn't always last that long. And so you really have to keep that under some real tight regulation.
Yeah, I understand. Thank you. That was a piece called Bluey Bluey, written and performed by Edith Baker. I say written because actually that's a misnomer. It never was written down. So the sheet music does not exist, but it exists only on piano roll. And fortunately, those rolls were preserved over the years, and we can study the works of Edith Baker because of that. Okay, let's get back now to a little more of our interview with Paul Johnson. We'll talk a little bit about the development that led up to the player piano. Certainly, it just didn't magically appear one day.
No, actually, you know, it's kind of like I liken the development somewhat to the automobile. You know, we always think maybe, you know, we label Henry Ford as the guy who invented it. But actually, when you look into a lot of these types of inventions, you see that it was a number of different people and inventions coming together to get the final result. So people were starting to play around with creating player piano. Certainly before that, before the 1840s, they had self-playing pianos, but they were barrel pianos, which were basically pianos. The mechanism was struck or plucked from a little pin that came out from a barrel. And they had those types of things, but they were trying to get something beyond that. So there was a lot of development, say, from the 1840s to the 1870s, where they were trying out different ways of transporting it. They had a number of different problems to solve. For example, how do you have a note strike and hold that note? What kind of media were you going to use for the music? And, how were you going to propel it? And all those types of things. So basically by 1876, which was the Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia, there were different people displaying things, and there was people displaying different types of player pianos. And if you looked across all three of them, you'd see that all the technology was there for the final product, but they still hadn't gotten all the ideas into one place. So there was a lot of development into the 1870s, and probably one of the key companies that was involved with it was the Aeolian Company. They were the Aeolian Organ Company, and they, in 1888, they bought out the Automatic Music Paper Company of Boston, and they were selling organs, and they started selling player organs, and so those were foot-pumped organs that would play a role, and I think they saw a lot of success with that, and it made them think, well, there's so many pianos out there. If we can use the same kind of player technology, but for a piano, we might have a great market there. And so eventually they had a gentleman named Edwin Vogte, and he came out with the what was called the pianola in 1895, and that took a lot of the inventions that had happened before, including the organ technology that they had and the roll technology that they had, and put it into one unit. And that unit was a cabinet that would push up to a piano, and it has little fingers that come out, and you pump it like you do a normal piano with your feet. But the fingers would come out, and they would play the piano, and that was what was called a pianola. Now we call it a push-up, and later on, the technology was eventually built into the piano, so it was all in one.
I see. Let's pause for a minute here and play a very early example of automated music. This actually is a music box. It's a recording of a music box that Paul sent to me. The tune is A Warm Reception, written in 1899 by Bert Anthony. Thank you. Once again, an automated music box playing A Warm Reception by Bert Anthony, Cakewalk from 1899. All right. Back now to more of our interview with Paul Johnson. Let's say that we have a player piano, but what good is a player piano without rolls?
Oh, so well,
how do you make rolls?
Well, a player piano still can be used just like a regular piano. It can, all the stuff folds up into the piano, and at least the pedals and things, and so you could still play it like a regular piano, which is certainly a great selling point. But yeah, if you really want the player part, you have to have the rolls. And rolls were made basically a few different ways. Early on, the technology was what they called arranged rolls, and they're called kind of metronomic rolls, which means they moved along at a very steady pace.
And they sound mechanical, don't they?
Yes, they do, because they are just... They're kind of just laid out almost like on a graph paper, and I think the early arrangers would come in and they would mark up this graph paper, you know, with the notes and the timings and everything, and you know they would do their full arrangement, and then I believe that then another crew of people would come in and cut out the roll, they would listen to it, maybe do some editing, and send it out the door, and reproduce it. So that was the early arranged rolls, and then later on. First in 1905 with Welty, but they were kind of a German-based company that was off in Germany, and they weren't really well distributed. It was really 1911 with the QRS company. They came out with their hand-played roll series. And there, an artist could sit down at a recording piano and record a piece. And that was a big game changer, particularly for ragtime, because it meant you didn't have to go through the whole process of writing down the piece, working with a publisher, convincing them to publish it, and you know, going through all that rigmarole to get a piece out the door. Now, an artist could have a ragtime piece that they knew wanted to get out there, and they could just sit at a recording piano, have it mark the roll, and it gets cut out, and then, bang, it's on the shelves. So that was a big development for the time.
Uh-huh. I think I jumped the gun here a little bit. You say they were cut out. I know that the rolls have little tiny holes in them.
Yeah.
But why?
Oh, okay. Good question. Well, a player piano, a lot of people think when you're pumping it, you're pushing air out. But actually, it's all based on a vacuum. And so there's little pedals down at the bottom, and as you're pumping, you're creating a vacuum in this player system. And up at the top is what they call the spool box, and that's where the roll goes. And the roll goes over a roll reader, and we call it a tracker bar. And there are little holes in the roll. The latest standard was there 9 holes to the inch across, but there's one hole for each note of the piano, so there's 88 notes. And when one of those notes, one of those holes opens up in the tracker bar, it sends a gust of air down into a pipe, and that sends it out to a little bellows or kind of just a little pouch. And that pouch opens up, and it causes a linkage to hit the key and strike the key. And so that's kind of how they work that way. It's all very... pretty unique and interesting the way they developed that.
I had no idea it was vacuum. I always thought it was the other way around.
yeah, that's what most people think.
Okay, a few words about this next piece. This is a rag written in 1912 by Julia Niebergall. It's called Red Rambler. Paul had mentioned earlier that one of the better arrangers, more popular arrangers of ragtime rolls was a woman named Mae Brown. So this is her arrangement of Red Rambler, and it's an example of an arranged roll that would add extra notes and a little bit of extra syncopation as it went along. Red Rambler Rag, played and arranged by Mae Brown. Okay, moving on now to some more of our interview with Paul Johnson. Well, now, player pianos became pretty big business there at the beginning of the 20th century, didn't it? Sort of.
Yeah, they were. Well, you know, it was a time when the piano was kind of considered the center of the home, and it was also a status symbol. So if you had a piano in the home, it was a sign that you would have arrived into at least the middle class. And so to take something that was really quite ubiquitous at the time and make it into something where anyone could come in and play music was something that had a lot of appeal. And that's kind of really what caused them to be successful. But I think going back to Aeolian, you know, with their organ company, you know, they saw that success. And I think they made a lot of money doing it with the organs. And so they were able to come out with their pianola. And they introduced that in 1897, really, to the market. But they put a lot of money behind their ad campaigns. I've seen some ads that were published, like, around 1902. And they're, like, four-page ads.
My goodness.
And they're really kind of educating the market of why you need one of these things. And I think they had to do a lot of that. Of, you know, probably people said, well, what's this going to do for me? And I think they really saw it as something that would allow people to enjoy music in their homes with the piano that they were going to have anyway, and without having to have years and years of lessons, or having someone in the house who had years of lessons.
Right. Now, I've got some CDs, actually, that are where piano rolls have been recorded and released on CD. You mentioned that there were 88 holes on this reader bar, but some of them say 65. What's going on there?
Oh, okay, yeah, that's a good question. Well, when the pianola first came out, and I think even with the earlier organs, they were on a what we call a 6-to-the-inch scale, which kind of goes across from left to the right, and they were bigger holes, and they covered 65 notes of the 88-note scale, so kind of just the center part, mostly the center two-thirds of the keyboard, if you will. And that was a very popular format for the beginning, you know, from 1897 all the way into, say, 1907, 1908, when they started, the 88-note standard started coming out. And it was so popular, in fact, when they started bringing out player piano rolls, or player pianos in the, you know, say, 1905 period, and they had the 88-note standard, people said, well, what am I going to do with all my 65-note rolls? So they actually made tracker bars that would play both styles, that would play both the 65 and the 88s. But that's the 65 note is generally the earlier style of piano roll, and if you have something that it will have pin ends on it, it indicates that it's probably from the, you know, 1895 to 1905 period,
yeah,
which still includes quite a bit of ragtime, especially the early ragtime. But I should also say that that format was used later on for Nickelodeon rolls. So if you have Nickelodeon rolls, which can have some great music too, you can cut down recuts of those and play them on a 65-note scale.
Some of the... let's interrupt this interview here and talk about our next piece, which is a bit unusual. This is a piece that Paul suggested that I pull out of my collection and play. It's a recording by David Thomas Roberts of a piece called Missouri Mag. And it has an what Paul considers to be an error. David learned this piece by listening to a 65-note piano roll over and over again. Well, the piano roll had a flaw in it. And so David actually plays the flaw in this piece, which is kind of interesting. He in his liner notes say that the measure, instead of having 16 sections the section has 16 measures. Instead, it has 14 3/8 measures because of this. And that's the way he plays it. Paul is pretty convinced that this is not the way that it was originally recorded. It's actually a flaw in the roll. So having said that, let's listen to David Thomas Roberts playing Missouri Mag. Of a scratchy vinyl recording by David Thomas Roberts of Missouri Mag. I hope you were able to detect that flaw where it suddenly ended in the wrong place and moved on to the next section. Okay, time now to move on to another section of our interview with Paul Johnson. Some of the recordings that I have are listed as arranged, and others are not. What's the difference there?
Oh, okay. Well, it could be sometimes they may not say it's arranged. I mean, if they didn't say anything, it still could be arranged. But an arrangement means that someone came in and like I mentioned earlier, they kind of laid out the piece. Now, early on in the process, they would just take the sheet music and basically convert it to a piano roll. They didn't do anything as far as it added notes or anything like that. Later on, as time went on, they realized, well, we have more notes available to us than even people have fingers. And they would start to create arrangements that were fuller and more pleasing. And actually, as you start to get into, say, 1903, 1904, companies like QRS, which was a major roll company at the time, they came out of Melville Clark, but also U.S. Music Roll Company, they would add notes. It wasn't like a crazy type of arrangement where it was very, you know, not overarranged, but they would add in notes that would fill out the harmonies and create a fuller-sounding performance, and it can be quite pleasing. I learned to play a piece called Brand Dance Shuffle, and that's like 1903 or something like that, because I'd heard the piece on a roll. And when I compared the sheet music to the arrangement on the roll, I could see they did some very subtle but nice arranging things to the piece that you almost wouldn't notice if you hadn't looked at it.
Uh-huh.
So, but that's what arranging was. They would lay it out because they didn't really have that technology for hand playing yet. And that's, you know, quite a few rolls. That kind of technology and the way of producing rolls went up until, you know, about 1912, 1915.
Now, I have a friend who has, I always thought it was a player piano, but he refers to it as a reproducing piano. What's that
yeah.
about?
Well, so when you have a standard kind of player piano, you have all the, you know, the rolls and things like that. But part of that is you are kind of responsible for interpreting the piece yourself, with various levers and dynamics and things that you can control. With a reproducing piano, the idea is to have the piano stand on its own and actually recreate a performance. And those started out in 1905 in southern Germany with Welty. They created a process where, you know, they made two significant inventions. One was a way to record hand playing so that you caught all the rubato, the phrasing that a pianist was using, and they also developed a way, which is even more impressive, of capturing the dynamics that that person recorded. And what's very interesting about Welty is that later on researchers have been able to determine that when they were recording those dynamics, they were recording it real time, because they noticed that sometimes when the piece got difficult, the phrasing and the dynamics might get a little muddy. So it tells you that they were recording those dynamics real time when they were recording those rolls. So they're like a real, you know, record of a recording.
Uh-huh. Very good. Paul has suggested that we play three pieces here to kind of illustrate what he's talking about. The first is another pop tune from the 20s called The Trail of the Lonesome Pine, and it's another example of Mae Brown's ragging style as she played and arranged, or arranged and played, I guess, these roles that she made. So let's listen to that one.
Thank you.
On the Trail of the Lonesome Pine, arrangement by May Brown. And if your ears picked up the fact that there were more notes being played than there are fingers on a pianist's hands to play, you were right. So it's part of the arranging and adding extra notes and, of course, kicking up the speed at the end with all sorts of fancy tricks. So I'm sure that edition sold a lot of piano rolls. People would invite neighbors over to watch this player piano in their home doing these, making this incredible music. Paul also talked about reproducing pianos, and here is one of those on a Welty reproducing piano from 1905. The tune is called Écossaise, and it's written by Beethoven, because not all piano rolls were of pop tunes or rags or things like that. There were a lot that were put out that were classical pieces. And if you listen carefully to this very nice piece by Beethoven, I think you will probably agree that it does not sound like a piano roll. It sounds like the real deal. That was Écossaise by Beethoven, played by a renowned concert pianist named Carl Reinecke. Let's move on now to another reproducing role, this one played by Felix Arndt. And Felix actually composed this piece in 1915. It's called Nola, and it became very, very popular. It's even popular today. Piano students are having a difficult time playing this because it's not an easy piece to play, but Felix Arndt actually recorded this role himself. Thank you. Felix Arndt at the piano, playing his own composition of Nola. I have to believe that there are listeners out there who are saying to themselves, I tried to play that when I was younger. Anyway, a nice way to hear how the composer actually played the piece. And of course, then you did have the option of buying the sheet music and being able to listen to the piano roll while you watch the sheet music and perhaps get a better idea of how you yourself should be playing the piece. Okay, well, we have a little time left, and so I'm going to throw in a couple more piano rolls to listen to tonight. We'll be doing part two of our interview with Paul Johnson next week, moving on to more topics like Nickelodeons and recording, reproducing pianos, different styles of playing, and ultimately getting into digital reproducing pianos, which are available today. So let's get back to a little more music here to close the program out. One of the things Paul mentioned along the line was that things have been recorded on piano rolls that have not been recorded anywhere else. And because those rolls still exist, we have them to play and to refer to. And then, of course, a piano roll can be recorded on an LP record or on a CD. And these treasures can be available in digital format and other types of formats as well. So having said that, I'm going to turn to the original piece that we started the whole show out tonight with, or the original recording, I guess, and that is the piano rolls of Scott Joplin. Joplin never recorded on a record, but he did record some piano rolls, and so we get to hear how he actually plays his own pieces. So let's give a listen to Joplin playing his most famous piece from 1899. Here is his role of the Maple Leaf Rag. Thank you. Scott Joplin on piano roll, our only recorded link with the famous ragtime composer, the man that sort of started the whole ragtime revolution back in 1899 with that piece, the piano roll, the Maple Leaf Rag. Okay, moving on now to another piano roll. This is by a gentleman named Charlie Strait, who was a well-known pianist back in the 1920s, late teens and early 20s, did mostly novelty piano-type works, and we don't have any records of him, but we do have lots of piano rolls by Charlie Strait. So let's listen to this one. It's called Ragabit, and it was recorded in 1918. Charlie Strait playing his composition, Ragabit. Yes, well, time to call it quits. We've been talking to Paul Johnson this evening about the history of piano rolls, and we'll be playing part two of this interview next week, along with a lot of great examples that he has selected to listen to. So hope you've enjoyed this and that you'll tune in next week for the completion of this interview. This is Jack Rummel saying thanks for joining us on Ragtime America this evening, and I look forward to joining you again next week. You're listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, 88.5 FM, 1390 AM, and on the web at kgnu.org. Stay tuned for Swing Shift.
Ha ha ha! Well, thanks again, Boris, and a hearty good evening, ladies and gentlemen. David Gloss, your usual host for this program, has been unavoidably detained. So I, Bella, will take over for a little bit until Mr. Gloss may return. Tonight we continue on with our Halloween celebration here on KGNU's Swing Shift, and we commence with my favorite way to spend the day, actually. Here's Artie Shaw's Nightmare.